Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hi, I'm Mari Forth.
And I'm Sarah Carradine, podcasting from the lands of the Wurrati people of the Muwinina Nation in Nipaluna, Hobart.
And this is Crime Scene, the true crime review podcast where we get to the heart of how true crime stories are told.
Subscribe to our feed, robhasawebsite.com/crimefeed, to get your true crime on Tuesdays when we drop in the main feed on Wednesdays. Mari, what are we talking about today?
Let's open today's file. We watched Trainwreck, Woodstock 99 on Netflix. It's a three-part docuseries directed by Jamie Crawford, who also directed the series The Interrogator, as well as Banged Up Abroad and America, the Promised Land. And to discuss it, we have a wonderful guest with us.
If you say so.
Our second favorite Texan, the irrepressible, the irresponsible, the indescribable, Chappelle, what's up, Chappelle?
Hello, Sarah.
Hello, Chappelle. Welcome to Crime Scene.
I can't speak to Mari after that introduction. I don't know what to say. I am so happy to be here. Thank y'all both for having me. But yeah, that was so accurate.
Chappelle, we're glad to have you here. Will you be answering the question, is nudity unity?
I heard the phrase in this documentary and I would just like to talk it out. I just think we should have the discussion. I don't know if it's a fact that is the case, but there were moments in this documentary where I felt like maybe not, just maybe not.
Definitely, exactly that. Welcome to the podcast for the first time. So because of that, we have to ask you our question. What is your true crime origin story? Are you a true crime fan? Are you not a true crime fan? And technically, this is your second time, but it's okay. This is your first time without the big boss man looking over your shoulder.
Was I the first episode? Was I like the... I thought we did a crossover. Does that...
It was episode zero, yeah. So episode
technically,
zero.
Yeah. So I've been here before. This is for me, you know what I'm saying?
However you want to look at it.
Obviously, I have a background in true crime per the first episode of this very podcast. But no, seriously, I am not a true crime person. A lot of it seems kind of scary to me, honestly, a lot of the like murdering and stuff. But listening to y'all's podcast, I've heard so much stuff that's interesting that's not really what I think of as true crime. So I remember the fruitcake fraud and, you know, the blue bell ice cream stuff. I'm like, oh, that's the kind of crime that I like, basically because they happen in Texas, but also because
and because they're about food.
Okay, listen, I just got here and that's like the second or third time y'all have attacked me. Let's just slow down. But also accurate. So yeah, that like seeing these parts of crime has made me like open my mind to the idea of true crime. But in general, no, I'm not a true crime person.
Yeah, we're trying to do a good job at, you know, opening the scope, because we truly are in one of those societies where crime is everywhere. You know, we don't have to just talk about the grisly stuff. And the good thing is there's a lot of properties out here that we can talk about. So so happy to have you on for this one. The formerly known as Clusterfuck Woodstock 99 is now known as Trainwreck Woodstock 99. Let's get into the crime. So, or crimes? Mostly crimes, unknown crimes, lots of crimes, but not crimes. Yeah.
Criminal activity for sure.
Definitely.
If greed is a crime, this was a crime. And greed is a crime.
Good point. Woodstock 99 was a 3-day festival held in July in Rome, New York. Organized by Michael Lang, one of the co-founders of Woodstock 69, or the original Woodstock, and John Shearer, a music promoter, held at the decommissioned Griffiths Air Force Base. 250,000 people paid $150 a ticket for the weekend. Due to what many see as the greed of the organizers, the festival was marred by intense heat with no shade, overpriced food and water, appalling unsanitary conditions leading to sickness, sexual harassment, and at least 5 rapes, looting, vandalism, arson, assault, violence, and death. 5,162 medical cases were reported. 3 people died, one from hyperthermia, one from being hit by a car, and a man who had been at Woodstock 69 died from heat stroke. 44 people were arrested. One of their arrests was a prison guard who sexually assaulted a 15-year-old girl. 10 state troopers, 2 state police supervisors were demoted or suspended, and it took 3 weeks to clean the site. So that's the official crime. Now, a good portion of that is not covered in this documentary. and we will go through that. The docuseries did leave out a large portion of basically the fallout of the event itself. But before that, Chappelle, give us your overall quick thoughts about the docuseries itself.
White people crazy. These people is nuts. seeing this, the footage, I was just enamored by all of it. I was thinking, why did this happen? And how many different ways could this have been prevented? Throughout the entire documentary, you're just like, you should have did this, but you did this instead. You should have did this, but you did this instead. And the whole time I was trying to figure out, why do they hate this man so much? John Shearer, because they purposely got him out here looking like a fool. He's saying one thing and they are showing footage of the complete opposite. It's like, for Saturday was fine. Friday was fine. Sunday it got a little violent. It's like, no, we just watched 2 episodes of violence from Friday and Saturday. They hate him so much. So yeah, my general opinion is this is a lot. Mm-hmm. And white folks is crazy.
Sarah, how about you?
Well, yeah, why? What are these white boys? I was fascinated. I mean, I'm absolutely fascinated by this documentary, and it was astonishing. I mean, as Chappelle says, one of the real strengths of the documentary is to get the talking head, John Shearer, the music promoter, and the late Michael Lang, talking about both contemporaneously and now, talking about how well it's all going and how it was a few bad seeds and how there was an acceptable amount of sexual assault John Shear die. And then we are seeing it. We're seeing official footage. We're seeing personal footage. I mean, the director, Jamie Crawford, and the producer, whose name escapes me at the moment, but I'll give it to you later, they spend a lot of time soliciting personal mementos from people who were actually there. And I think that care really shows. And they lay it out for us, a lot of juxtaposition of this was said, but this was happening. And they laid out, they're not telling us what to think, but wow, what a beast that festival was, and what an interesting documentary. For once, I was happy that it was three parts, Mari.
Right, yeah. Oh, my gosh. We are about to get an episode where I'm like, this was amazing. I love the three-parter. I thought it was laid out brilliantly. Like, it must be, like, pigs must be flying outside. But I completely agree. I thought the three-part documentary, like, docuseries was perfect layout for this. Essentially, each part, like one day of Woodstock covered each part. But that kind of leads me into our first discussion point. Episode one was a little different. When I first turned it on, one of the first things that grabs you about this docuseries is literally the content, like what you're being shown. Like Sarah said, them gathering all of the footage. There was just so much footage of that day. So a lot of it is the, you know, the real time footage of what we're seeing from these people. And it reminds me a lot of when we did Gladbeck. It really sets the tone. It really sets the mood. Like, it really puts you back there when you see that original footage. But the first episode was very, like, once I went back and watched it again, it was just like, I don't know if I enjoyed the cutting back and forth between the festivities of day one at Woodstock and the preparation for it. I get what they were trying to do, but I think it would have been better because we saw it in the last two episodes. The last two episodes were just straight up. Day two was episode two. Day three was episode three, plus like the aftermath. But the aftermath was literally at the end. I think if they would have started with the preparation, all the preparation footage first, tell us the preparation, then go through day one, that would have been better. But other than that, I still enjoyed the content. Did you guys notice that? Like in the first episode, they go back and forth between, okay, so we get some of our talking heads are actual concert goers. We have them talking about them going to the concert, them getting up to the concert. Then we'll smash cut to a year earlier. And then they'll talk about what they did a year earlier to prepare for Woodstock. Then we go back to day one. Oh, okay, we're getting in. We're doing this. We're doing this. And then smash cut back. Oh, 7 months earlier. Like, it was a lot of jumping back and forth. What did we think about the format of the first episode here? Just the formatting, and we'll get into the content next.
When I did the first watch through, it did not bother me. When I was taking my notes, I really noticed it. And as some of our viewers are probably just watching and not taking notes, it may not be. It didn't. The short version of that is, it didn't bother me. As much as you found it.
I don't think it was bothersome. I just, when you see how well it worked the next two episodes, I kind of just wished it was formatted the same. Does that make sense? Chappelle, what do you think?
I kind of lean toward you, Mari. I remember watching the first episode and there were moments where they were prepping for it, but they didn't really prepare you for that. So it's kind of like they show parts of Woodstock and then you're following the story and then all of a sudden they're talking again, but it's the same person talking, but 3 months earlier. And they're talking about the setup and the layout, but they don't give you like a good, like they don't give you like a big card in front that says 3 days before all the time. They do it like once. And then at that point, you're supposed to be able to keep up with that. It is a little jarring. And then you tie that into the fact that they're still showing clips from the first Woodstock. And I think they might have had a clip or two from Woodstock 94.
94,
so,
yeah, they did.
Yeah, and so it's kind of like, it's a lot thrown at you at the same time. But I do agree that it wasn't horrible. It is something that I noticed, though.
Yeah. Exactly. You really had to be paying attention for the cards because they threw the cards up and then they were gone, you know? So you really had to pay attention. But other than that, let's get into some of the meat and potatoes, especially of like episode one. So like Chappelle pointed out, we did get like a little bit about the original Woodstock. Of course, you know, they talk about, oh, Woodstock 69, it was counterculture, it was peace, love, hippies, blah, blah, blah. It was held in Bethel, New York, and Michael Lang and his team, they really wanted to do something akin to that. And then we got a little bit of Woodstock 94, talking about how it rained, how the fences got pushed down, how there was entertainment, but they didn't make any money. One of my questions to you guys is, should we have gotten a little bit more here on the differences between like Woodstock 69, maybe even Woodstock 94 and Woodstock 99?
That's a bit of a can of worms because the Woodstock 69 was not without its problems. I mean, people died. Mm-hmm. Hell's Angels were the security, and that's why people died. And there's footage of them beating a man to death. It was, I'm sure there were sexual assaults, you know, free love. Oh, it's supposed to be free. Give me my free love. I won't, you know, go on too much about it. But I think that what this documentary wanted to do, and I think was successful in doing, is the idea of Woodstock 69, the idea of peace and love, the idea of 500,000 people gathering in a field and it being a peaceful, careful, loving community was on certainly Michael Lang's mind and wanted to give that experience to the kids of today. I think to go into the details of what actually was happening at 69, the peace, love, music, fabulous, but other stuff as well, I think might have derailed this train wreck. Chappelle, what did you think?
That's a good point. I didn't really think about it in the moment, but now that you mentioned Woodstock 69, yeah, these people are able to have a level of dissonance when it comes to that event because of the vibe, right? That is the whole, it's the idea of peace and love and music, and we're all out here as unity and all this other stuff. But then that's their perspective as the privileged people who didn't have to deal with that darker side of Woodstock. And now here we are in Woodstock 99, and the same thing is happening. You know, like there are moments of peace. There are moments of unity and love. We see that throughout the film. But also, there's darker side. And there's a bigger, darker side that these people couldn't even ignore, as hard as they tried to ignore it. I mean, they are saying throughout this documentary that, oh, we didn't even notice anything until day three, or it didn't really get bad until after this performance. But it's like, no, that's not the case. And it's unrealistic for you to call it that. And so, yeah, I do think it's interesting that they're able to separate themselves mentally from what they would like to have happened ideally, or what they were experiencing from their point of view, from the actual reality. So more of that for Woodstock 69 wouldn't have hurt, but also I think it would have derailed, like Sarah said, it would have derailed, honestly, the conversation that they were trying to have. They were trying to like paint a picture that this is a different group of people. You can't select the people who buy your tickets. The kids of the 90s were just different. These were just violent frat boys, and it'd never been like this before. It's not our fault. But you can't do that if you say, okay, well, what about the stuff in 69? Did you not see that stuff happening again? And so, and I'm sure in 94, when the weather was bad and there was mud everywhere, I'm sure there was some of that going on too, if you're not, you know, securing the grounds properly and making sure that everybody's taken care of. So I think adding that stuff would have probably thrown the documentary for a loop. It wouldn't have accomplished their goal. And, but I would like to see it. I'd like to start there personally.
We need another documentary. I mean, the salient point for me from 94 is that they breached unticketed concert goers breached the fences, and Woodstock 94 did not make money. That is the seed of what happens with 99, where there's they use the word impenetrable like it's a good thing. There's an impenetrable fence around the Air Force base. I suppose it's good for an Air Force base. And plus, this has to make money. And that became the driving force.
Yeah. And that's true. They did get that across. I think, I guess, just with my very literal mind, I did want to know a little bit more about like how the finances and stuff worked for them to not make money, but it makes sense. I think we got a little bit about like in 69, they had like free food kitchens. Like I really would have loved just maybe a side by side of just the little stuff like that, like who provided the food in 69 and 94 and stuff like that. But I get it. I think it was, I do agree with both of you. I think it was laid out enough so you understood what the main motivator was for 99, and that was capitalism, money, yay. but I do like what Chappelle kind of touched on here, the disconnect between the different generations and also the Band-Aid book. So how did we feel about kind of them saying like, oh, this generation was just not about the counterculture, the peace and love like that generation was? I personally kind of feel like no, this could be this is counterculture. It's just the 90s counterculture. You know what I'm saying? The 90s counterculture, unfortunately, didn't go. It wasn't countering the Vietnam War with peace and love. It was countering the greed of the 80s with nihilism, anarchy, you know, burn it down. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's what their counterculture was. And they really should have probably thought about that with the bands they booked. You know, they booked Limp Bizkit, Korn, Red Hot Chili Peppers, like a lot of those, the new metal era bands, which, you know, I don't know about you guys. I did listen to some new metal, not a lot because, but I was very familiar with all of these bands with at least like one or two songs from a lot of them. But is it to say that it's the generation's fault and the bands that they book's fault, or is it to say that it's the promoter's fault, or should we leave this to the end? We could leave this question to the end, but maybe just some quick thoughts on maybe a different generational shift, Chappelle.
Right. I don't want to talk about the blame into the end because that's when they want to talk about it. But definitely, yeah. I see exactly what you're saying. Just, I don't know if it's even just the generation of people, because you trying to paint a whole generation of people by the MTV 8-17 to 23-year-old crowd, that is that's ineffective because there are more than the people who were there, right? Like, this is a very white function. That's why I started off saying, like, white people crazy. Not to say that black folk ain't crazy, too. We crazy. But this function was very, very white. I mean, all the acts, except for one, were white, it seems. And then, like, most of the people there, the demographic was white. And so it's like, it's not that you picked a generation. It is that you picked a subculture. You picked a rebellious subculture within this community, right? Like, even the bands that you were talking about, Rage Against the Machine is something that people were hoping was there, right? And they're this anti-authoritarian, you know, revolutionary-ass band. And so it's like, if you have that, then you're going to have people who like that kind of music. They had the same opportunity to get more Sheryl Crow's, more Jules. They did not.
Bush.
When you had, right. Listen, we can talk about Bush in a minute. But it just.
We saw plenty of Bush in the footage.
So that's inappropriate, but also I'll allow it. it was one of those things where it's just like, you had the opportunity, the Willie Nelson in the morning, you had the opportunity to change the vibe. And you didn't want to, and you weren't open-minded enough to hear out people, the naysayers from that generation. A 22-year-old on staff was saying, hey, these are not the bands that you want to get if you're trying to capture that old vibe from Woodstock. And they shut them down. So I think it's more, if you want to talk about generations, maybe it's the older generation's lack of awareness or inability to, you know, ingest different ideas, you know, from the younger generation. You know, had they listened, then maybe this would have gone differently.
Agreed. Sarah?
Yes. I mean, three women, one on each day. I mean, that has to be deliberate.
Oh, my God.
It's like, oh, we better get a couple of chicks. I mean, Michael Lang had not heard of most of the bands, so he trusted John Scher. That's not taking the blame away from Michael Lang. It's your party, dude. Like, figure out who these people are. And I think John Scher just probably Googled. Not that there was Google. Was there Google in my time? I can't remember.
They ask Jeeves.
He asked Jeeves, who are the biggest selling bands currently? So
who can we make the most money off of?
Who can make the most money off? And I don't think that you will necessarily have problems at a Limp Bizkit concert if you give the infrastructure, if you give the safety. So again, there's a whole thing about, it's the band's fault for inciting violence. It's not. You knew they were poisonous snakes when you brought them to the festival, if they are. They will behave as they will behave, and their fans will behave as they will behave. You must accommodate them. I mean, the black performers were James Brown, who opened.
And Wycliffe Jean.
All the performers did talk. I mean, this is slightly off topic, but all the performers did talk about the waves of energy. Some enjoyed it, and some didn't. You know.
Yeah, all right. I think it's important to talk about too that people for like since the beginning of music have been blaming music for their problems, right? Like, right. Oh, jazz music is going to make you go blind and Elvis is going to make you go to black men. You know, like it was a whole thing. And I think that this is another example of that. They're saying, oh no, we brought in these music acts that were inciting this through their lyrics and all this other stuff. It's like, no, maybe the music didn't help, but also the atmosphere that you created when you basically have no security there, you are allowing just all kinds of drug use. I mean, they take away everybody's flammable stuff, but and water apparently,
and
but
waters.
People manage to get all kinds of drugs in there. And so you do that. And then you just put them out there in the worst facilities, you know, where it's just like, just be outside in the open for 3 days. And it's like, yeah, maybe they weren't mad. But once they start to hear the mad music and they start to feel madder as they start to realize that they were being exploited and mistreated out here. Yeah, I think all that combined would make anybody go a little crazy. And so I cannot not blame the production of the of Woodstock for this. This is not going to fall at the feet of anybody in the music industry that was involved, because they just did their songs. You know, artists can't make anybody do these things, but the atmosphere that people are in definitely can.
Yeah,
yes, that environment had such a big impact, Chappelle, as you say. Both Woodstock 69 and 94 were on grass. This was on asphalt. So they were out there in 100-degree
weather
with no shade. But that asphalt is going to throw heat up from
right
the bottom
back.
As well, right back. I mean, we saw people crawling under cars to try and get shade. And yes, all food and drink was and water was confiscated at the gate by the peace patrol. But apparently if you slipped them a 20, they would let you take your drugs in.
Yeah. So let's get into kind of like a little bit of what we're told by the concert goers, what their experience was. We were able to get a speak pipe from one of our listeners. So we're going to stop and listen to that right now.
Hi, Sarah, Mari, and Chappelle. My name's Kristen. And when I was 21 years old, I drove 700 miles from Chicago, Illinois to Rome, New York, to attend Woodstock 99. From the moment that we got there, it looked like things were not going well logistically, and the town and the venue weren't really prepared for the amount of people descending upon it that weekend. We ended up setting up our tent right outside of the gate because there wasn't room in the designated area for camping inside the venue. In hindsight, that probably worked out for the best. Watching the documentary was frustrating. The promoters were either delusional or just downright deceitful. Upon arriving, we were told that we would need to have our tickets on hand anytime we were going in and out because the boxes of wristbands that were supposed to be handed out when you first entered had been stolen. So from the get-go, it was clear that security was an issue. Food and drink was incredibly expensive when we got there. It was full-on stadium prices, but we were supposed to be there for 3 days, so it was just not sustainable. But even if you were willing to pay those prices, it was damn near impossible to get food because the lines were so long. So we were so thirsty and so hungry the entire time we were there. We left to go into town, and that was a nightmare. Traffic was so incredibly bad getting out of the venue, trying to get into town, and the few restaurants that they did have in this small town were completely slammed with people trying to get some food. By the end of Saturday, we were so completely depleted physically and emotionally. We were hot, exhausted, hungry, dehydrated, that after Metallica on Saturday night, we just ended up taking off back for home. And it was so crazy to be home Sunday night and see all of the news reports about what was going on. Very, very thankful that we left when we did.
Thank you to Kristen for sending us that speak pipe. If you would like to send us a speak pipe, you can click the link in our show notes and send us one. Wow. I mean, Yeah, that sounds about right. Everything Kristen said in that speak pipe, I think was shown in the documentary. What Chappelle said, throwing their food out. So when you get in there, this was a 3-day festival where you stayed the night. And to not allow people to bring in water, not allow people to bring in food, then have the stadium style prices. They really went over that in the documentary. I love that they went over that in the documentary because they were talking about, like Sarah said, wanting to make money. The way they talked about it was the equivalent of water, like a bottle of water back then was about 65 cents standard at the time. At Woodstock, it was $4. You know what I'm saying? And the funny thing to me is like, in this time, I'm like, man, I would kill for some $4 water at festivals because at this point, it's normally higher than that. But like Kristen said, what the documentary didn't include was how Rome, New York, the town that they're in, also, you know, was flooded with people and people tried to go and use the town. That was the whole point. The town made money by people coming and using the resources. However, just like in Woodstock, where she said the lines were so long, you couldn't get food and water. In the town, the lines were so long that you could barely get food and water. So this honestly really was a recipe for a disaster because they ended up having about 250,000 people. I think they said total, maybe 400,000 people may have gone in and out of the concert over the weekend, depending. So it's just like this, they did not account for this. Sarah, what did you think about hearing some of the hardships that the concert goers went through?
Well, I mean, thanks Kristen for sending us this message. Interestingly, she doesn't talk about the music, enjoyment, nothing. I'm sure that she does also have, I'm not sure. She'll say if she has other memories that are good. I mean, there's an excitement there, but this is absolutely appalling. And in listening to people's memories, watching a few other documentaries and reading a few other things, people keep saying war zone and refugee camp. Sweeties, this was neither of those. However, that was the experience. That's what it felt like to these young kids. And the feeling of being disrespected, disregarded, and not looked after was, to me, the incitement for the riot. And then you get groupthink and crowdthink. And, you know, this thing of everybody here is like me, I am like them. That's the unity that they found. Was in each other, and the consequences were completely foreseeable. This is the thing. It wasn't something that you couldn't have seen coming. All along the way, decisions were made about money, that it was all about money, and I'm just the security, I mean, Kristen mentions that them as well, was laughable. I read things about people got their tag, they got their security shirt, went into the concert, threw them away, and then just had a great time for 3 days.
Yeah.
Chappelle?
No, that makes total sense, though. I mean, that's honestly what I would have done if I was in that position. You telling me, oh, are you random guy off the street? I want you to be security. And I'm like, this concert costs $150. Yeah, I'll be security, whatever. And now I'm in the concert. And I'm not coming in with any nefarious plans, but there are definitely people who probably are predisposed to do something like that. You have people who, once they get in that environment, don't know what they would do in that environment. And so you don't know who you're letting in for free, basically, just through the security guards. And then when you do that, you have lack of security. I think it's less about, you know, are those people like robbing the venue of that $150? And that definitely more of like, are you robbing these people of a legit experience where they don't have to look over their shoulder or be worried? I mean, DMX started yelling the N-word at people and white people start responding, I'm leaving. And so, you know, I already don't feel secure. And then you look around and it's like, oh, they're not security. They're peace patrol or whatever they call it. Like, I need a taser or something. Like, I need somebody to come in here and protect somebody because, you know, I'm not saying come in here and have armed guards, but you have to account for the amount of people that you have. I think at one point in the documentary, he says, well, Woodstock was about the size of a small town. And, you know, in a small town, crimes happen. It was like, yeah, but in a small town, there is a situation where there is an order set up. There's an infrastructure set up to keep those crimes from happening. He made it sound like, I mean, anytime you just put 20 people together, somebody, something's going to go wrong. I was like, And if you feel that way, why didn't you do anything about it? You know? And so it's hard to hear that. But thank you, Kristen. Yeah, I love hearing the firsthand accounts. And I think that's what works really well for the documentaries, that they have so many people, they have firsthand footage, but they also have so many people who were there who came back to tell their story.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, oh, I think the selection of concert goers that they found was really excellent, because they were not all, it wasn't all the same story, but it was also all the same story. So I found that really interesting.
Yeah. And the concert goers, the talking heads that were there, they told us from jump, like day one, just like Kristen said, you could tell something bad was going to happen, like from day one. And a lot of it, you know, they try to say that the energy starts with Korn. Korn was there on the first day.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business?
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Let's get into some of the acts that were there. I loved how they highlighted the acts that were going on and how they put on the title cards for the acts. I did not like how Sarah said that they did feel like they tried to blame some of those acts for stuff. But, you know, I think that there are a lot of good acts. We even start with a tale about James Brown being the opening act, and how John Shearer's on the phone with his manager saying like James Brown wasn't going to go on unless they got paid. I don't know what the point of that was. It was not
to show just what a big cock John Shearer is.
They hate that man.
That probably
they
was
really do.
Yeah.
It's really interesting to me that John Shear's view of that interaction is like how great he is. And I just immediately thought of what I know of particularly women, black women singers in the 50s and 60s. Some of them are very noted for their pocket. They take their pocketbook on stage with them, and white people are going, what, that's really odd. And the reason is they learned that if you sing first, you often don't get paid after. So they would insist on being paid first, and then you're going to put it in your pocketbook. Well, you ain't leaving that backstage. And as soon as John Shear's banging on about what a great man he is and how James Brown won't go on without being paid first, I thought, you just don't know. Like, you are so ignorant. So as soon it was like, oh, James Brown doesn't go on unless he's been fully paid first, I thought, yes,
yeah,
because he may be famous now, but there was a time that he wasn't, and black performers were asking, you have to pay me first because I know exactly what you're going to do if I sing first.
Yeah, I was thinking that too, mostly just because it's James Brown. You know, like, of course he would want to be paid first. What I didn't understand was why are we hearing about this story? But Sarah makes a great point in that it might have been John Shearer just being a jackass.
His point was just that, oh, Woodstock was so big that even James Brown couldn't stick to his guns, and even he would go on without getting paid because that's just the atmosphere that it was. Mari, James Brown grew up working in cotton fields. Like, that was legit, like, his first job. You got this man who, like Sarah said, a lot of these artists didn't have that security that they were going to get paid, especially a fair wage, their whole life. And so here it is, Jane mm-hmm. Brown in the 90s after, what, 40 years of a career?
Yeah.
Of course he wants his money right now. You being like, yeah, we got James Brown to go on without getting paid first. You know what I'm saying? That's how big my event was, popping this collar. Like, bruh, you look like you a horrible person throughout this entire thing. Mm-hmm. And it starts with that moment.
Yep. And again, then we get Sheryl Crow, who the at this point, the crowd is asking her to show her chesticles. I was like, come on, y'all. That's Sheryl Crow. Don't disrespect Sheryl Crow like
I love Sheryl Crow for just being like, if y'all give me 2 seconds, I'm going to go out in this crowd and I'm going to show them something. You know, like I'm finna. She was about to go out there and handle them. And I was like, man, yeah, she was not taking it. But that was so rude. So rude the entire time.
Rude. Yes. Mm. Korn got the energy up in the night. Like I like Korn. I was definitely a follow the leader Kornhead for a little bit there. But I thought it was really funny how they juxtapose Korn going out, getting them really, really riled up and like, oh, the pent up negative energy, it just is where it started. And then they're like, but we had Bush have to come after that. And then poor Gavin Rosdell, Mr. former Gwen Stefani, had to talk about following up Korn was very, very funny to me, especially when he was his very polite British accent. But Bush had to kind of bring the crowd down here, Chappelle. After on day one, they had to close it out, try and calm them down.
I'm a Bush fan. I am.
Really?
Oh, yeah. If he does Glycerin, I'm in the crowd screaming and That's crying, true. You know, like my Glycerin song. But he does. And even to Bush's credit, they do have more aggressive sounding music that is like Machine Head and stuff like that. Like they have like faster songs. But, you know, I think that's the vibe you wanted at a Woodstock type place, right? Like the music that was at Woodstock 69 is probably closer to a Sheryl Crow and a Bush than, you know, as we see later on, Red Hot Chili Peppers and, you know, Korn and different aspects of that. So it's like they were, so they were trying to bring the vibe of that music through these artists that just don't do that, you know? And so I'm happy. Like, see, for me, I would have probably left after Bush. I'm like, I'm good here. Y'all wilding. And I heard my act, so I'm finna go. But maybe DMX hasn't gone yet. So I don't know. I might stick around for DMX.
Yeah. And then of course, after Bush, we get after the first episode, we get it where the concert goers, it's like midnight. And then they can go to what's called the rave hangar. And the rave hangar, if you think all the stuff in the daytime was bad, the rave hangar just got steadily worse and worse as the docuseries went on and on.
Yeah. You can go there and hear Moby, for example. Moby did not have a good time at Woodstock 99. He and his team just yeeted out of there.
See, Moby, if they wanted another Woodstock original, like Woodstock 69, it should have been all Moby's. It should have been Moby, Sheryl Crow, and the Bushes of the world.
And Jewel.
They did not get that right. And Jewel. Yes. They did not get that right. But yeah, we end the first episode with the building. They do a really good job in this documentary, like building the tension, like just building. What's going to happen? What's going to happen? What's going to happen? When we open up the second episode and we get into the day two of it all, I really like this episode because not only do we get the juxtaposition of the acts that are going on and either them feeding the energy or, you know, but we also get a lot of the behind the scenes, and not just the production behind the scenes, but we get to talk to a paramedic. We get to talk to one of the security guys. And I think, was this the episode or was that episode 3 where we talked to the public health? I think public health is episode 3. Mm-hmm. But okay.
He was, even to this day, he has not gotten over opening the samples and seeing the contamination. Oh. We'll get to him. He's in episode 3.
You know, that's my favorite part. You know, that was my favorite part.
Yeah. Petri dishes. Come on.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So they open like day two and talking about Saturday, just about how filthy it was already. You know what I'm saying? Like, again, one night, this is after one night of what's supposed to be like at least 2-3 night type of thing. And like, there's filth everywhere. People can't get in. The lines for the water are just long. And then this day is 100 degrees. It's even hotter than the day prior. And so this is where we get trash is just everywhere. Waste management is just nowhere to be found. There's nobody in waste management. Just trash everywhere. We didn't get to talk to waste management in this documentary because they couldn't even show up to the documentary. They couldn't show up to Woodstock 99 and they couldn't show up to this documentary.
This wonderful Lisa Laws, who yes. was a photographer at the original Woodstock and is in fact the mother of Michael's assistant. And dear lady, she doesn't know where she is. I mean, I don't mean she's out of her mind. I mean, she goes around cheerfully calling out trash bags for your area. She doesn't sound like that because she's not Australian. And she gets abused. People tell her, well, you clean it up. Mm-hmm. So this tolling bell all the way through from day one of something's going to happen, something's going to happen, something's going to happen. And each of these little bricks is being put on. Mm-hmm. So when they say, you clean it up, it feels, when she's interviewed now, like she's thinking, oh, those impolite white boys. But in fact, what have you done for me? I've given you this $150. What have you done for me? So I'm not condoning that attitude, but that is they were made by society, but they were also made by the organizers and the situation of this festival. I'm not taking the blame away from them. But in this sort of slightly amusing section where she's offering to give them trash bags so they can clean up and they're answering her back, you do it. Why don't you do it? It's actually chilling.
Yeah, but I don't blame them, honestly. Like you said, Sarah, like in the moment, they paid $150 and now you're telling them, well, we're not giving you water. You're in the heat. You're laying on the ground. People are out here wilding because even though the documentary doesn't get into some sexual assaults until later on, I mean, we can just assume that they've already started to happen. I mean, you know, like let's be very clear. Y'all talk about it in day two and three, and day one, something probably didn't happen, at least something. And so you see all this stuff happening. You're probably uncomfortable. You're probably ready to go, but you spent your money. And now someone's handing you a trash bag like, oh, yeah, by the way, can you clean up for us? No, thank you. I know, like, if you just factor in inflation or whatever, like Coachella tickets right now are like $600. Right. And if I spend $600. Oh, no, I'm not picking up nothing. I'm sorry. Because I didn't pick up. Like, are y'all going to pay me back? What's the hourly rate for the sanitary? Like, I'll put on a sanitation shirt in a heartbeat and be on the staff, but y'all got to pay me. So I don't blame them being like, I don't want to pick up trash. Now, they were rude to that woman and they shouldn't have been. But at the same time, they were viewing the rudeness to the staff, you know, to the people who were in charge of this. My favorite part of this entire documentary, we haven't talked about her. Ananda Lewis is there. My first love.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes.
I love it.
Looking beautiful.
Jeez
Louise.
I mean, even at like 9 years old, I was like, yep, that's my wife. But, you know, they took out a lot of their anger on MTV as well as being like the face of who can we blame for this? Because you got this anti-authoritarian group of people out here and they're like, well, who should we be anti to? It's you, lady, who's handing me the trash bag. You know, it's you with the camera. And so I think that's why it ended up like that. But man, this poor lady, her heart was in the right place. And I like that for her, but she was just kind of out of her depth.
Yeah. And I mean, Wyclef told the crowd to throw the plastic bottles at him as he was guitaring a Star Spangled Banner on his guitar, which I couldn't tell if he was doing the tribute to Jimi Hendrix with that or not, but it felt like it. And he did a really good job. But also he was being pelted with water bottles. And I was like, look at Wyclef trying to be helpful. Now they can collect all of those plastic bottles and recycle them.
Oh, Mari.
Like really nicely. I mean,
dear sweet summer child. No. It was
it's
a
gonna
tribute
get clean.
To...
It's gonna get cleaned off the stage.
It's gonna get pushed into the crowd, Mari.
Just kicked into the crowd. There were a lot of acts who were, you know, nodding to Woodstock 69, completely missed by 250,000 people. And this was one of the moments.
Wanted people throwing trash because he was also playing the Osei Kingsley, whichever one. Both of them. So day two is where it's really starting to kick off, because also it was supposed to be the greatest day of the greatest festival in history, but it was honestly a hot mess. They said the temperatures got up to like 100 degrees. Kid Rock started playing at like 1 o'clock. That was another thing that I really liked about this documentary. They kept the time. They showed you the time of important events during each day. So I really like that. Like, I really like how easy it was to follow once they got into their timeline structure. But Kid Rock went on at like 1 o'clock in the afternoon on Saturday. It was peak temperatures. And this is where we were listening to the paramedic. I think his name was Jose, I want to say. Yeah. And he was just talking about how there's people passed out. He was in the medical tent right by the stage, and they're like people passing out due to heat stroke. They had IVs in people's arms. Kid Rock started, people were mosh pitting. They're moshing the whole weekend, but you know, people were getting hit in the head with bottles and stuff like that, and there's just blood everywhere. And yeah, like a 1,000+ people were treated for dehydration. The paramedic, he said he wanted to just give up at one point and just go home, because that's like how overwhelmed they were. And a lot of those stats that we gave you at the beginning of the podcast, those were not addressed in the documentary. The documentary really did not address the deaths, the three deaths that happened because of Woodstock. They only brush upon the injuries that were there. And then, like Chappelle said, they really lightly brushed on the sexual assaults, because at this point, like, you know, women are out there, or everybody's out there nude. There's a lot of nudity out there, but there's a lot of assaults and molestation happening. And, you know, like Chappelle said, there are rapes happening that they're just ignoring in this documentary. Sarah, well,
didn't cause any problems on site, John Scheer tells us.
Yes, right. They didn't find out until after the event.
Yeah.
Which I'm like, who would you tell?
Who would you tell? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes, because like Chappelle said, the Peace Patrol were really just kids that they picked off the street. They said that we got to talk to one of the security guys. He said he was 18 at the time. He's basically walking around and some dudes like, hey, I have to sign up people for security for this event. I'll pay you $500 and you get to do security for Woodstock. And he said, okay. He said, basically, they signed the sheet of paper and they were security. And yeah. I can attest to this because the yellow shirts, like me and James, we did security like this, like the CSC security events, like you go to like festivals and stuff and you see in there the yellow shirts. We signed up and did this when we were in college. I think it was like our sophomore year. After our sophomore year in college, we did a 4th of July festival here in DC. And same thing, we got paid $500. We were at the front of the gates just checking people's purses and stuff for flammable stuff and weapons. And then after we were done, we went home and got paid. Like, that shouldn't have been the security here at Woodstock. When you have 250,000 people on site for a 3-day long concert, art house, mini village, your quote unquote security should not be a peace patrol made up of people who are the same demographic of the people they're trying to patrol who have.
Yeah,
no
I mean,
authority.
That's a really good point. It was the young white boys who had these T-shirts. One I read about sold his T-shirt for $400 to someone.
Yes.
Someone said, oh, what does that T-shirt get you? And he said, it gets you everything. Give me $400. I mean, this is where one longs for the Hell's Angels.
I don't know about all that.
Yeah. This is interesting, because at the same time all this is happening, behind the wall, they're pampering the artist. And so you got one, like two Americas right there, right in the middle of this group. And you got one side that's just like, no, everything's great. Whatever. We had tents, we had food, they're bringing it. We had sponsors, Budweiser's there. All these people are just showing free stuff at us. Right. Mm-hmm. And then you're starving the people on the other side, price gouging, letting them get like assaulted, all kinds of stuff. And it's happening at the same exact time. And that is the craziest part of this to me. It's just, there's just like, and this is the group that you claim that would be rambunctious about this kind of a treatment, right? Like they claim like, oh yeah, this is just the generation. Well, why would you do that to this generation then? These are the people who are going to fight back against that kind of stuff, according to you. So yeah, it was a mess from beginning to end. And by the middle, I'm just like, yeah, Kid Rock is here. I'm good. I can go.
When I tell you, I just kept saying throughout the documentary, you can't tell me people weren't dying. Like, I just kept saying that over and over. And James is like,
they never talk about
you it. Want somebody to die so badly. I'm like, I don't. But the more they unravel about the unsanitary conditions, the heat itself, like, Jose, the paramedic, was talking about how he was hot just standing alone under a tent. There was 250,000 people like half naked in a mosh pit. When you watch the documentary, you see how large the crowd is. I am claustrophobic. This would not be me. You could not pay me to be in a crowd that deep, that thick. I could not do it. And I was just sitting there like, you can't tell me people aren't getting trampled. It was just, I just could not believe any of it. And then, of course, Saturday peaks with Limp Bizkit. Sarah, what was your thoughts on Limp Bizkit and Fred Durst coming out? And as one of the reporters at Talking Heads said, kerosene match, boom.
Boom. Yeah. I mean, Fred Durst gonna Fred Durst.
Right.
He is them. They are him. These are his. He can play this crowd like an orchestra. He raises his arm, they raise their arm. He bends down, they bend down. He leans forward, they lean back. It was kind of extraordinary. Like, there was a sort of a beauty and a grandeur, a terrible, horrible grandeur about this. You can't put a performing artist on that stage. You know, Alanis Morissette, Fred Durst, I don't care. You can't put a performing artist on that stage with these people breathing you in, taking you in, adoring you, screaming to you, reaching to you. And you can't say to them, oh, by the way, don't be you. I mean, if you're Alanis, you know, it's a bit ironic. If you're Fred Durst, it's burn this place down. When this song kicks in, you kick in. You are my people. He would have felt like a god on earth. And I don't blame him, because they asked him in. John Scher asked him in and put him on that stage in front of those uncontrolled, hot, tired, angry people, and said, here's a microphone. Oh, and by the way, just don't incite a riot.
Too late. Chappelle, any thoughts on Fred Durst?
I don't have a lot of thoughts on Fred Durst, because like Sarah said, he's just going to be who he is. But John is saying, well, I mean, I didn't account for him being such an asshole. Okay, well, really? I mean, yeah, like, one, why didn't you? But also, two, you cannot expect for him to reel in your crowd that you are mistreating. You know, he's saying, because what in an ideal world is what he would expect is for Fred Durst to get up there and say, oh, man, people are getting kind of riled up. Let me slow it down a little bit as the person in charge of this function. It's like, no, he's not in charge of this function. He is a performer. So he going to perform, and he going to get the crowd riled up so that they can buy more Fred Durst stuff, and they can buy more albums, and they can go to his concerts and stuff, because they're going to have this story that they're going to tell forever about Fred Durst. That's why he's there. He is not there to make sure they don't incite a riot or, you know, burn the place to the ground. So, no, if he had done just a pinch of research, he would not even have assumed Fred Durst could control 300,000 people. Like, that would just a modicum of effort put into that, and he would have already known this is a bad idea. At least once you start mistreating people, it's a bad idea.
Yeah. And I mean, it just, this is when they start attacking the sound tower. It's just kind of like it was a done deal at this point. It was just all of the frustration. We get Heather, one of the Talking Heads, who was a concert goer. She was 14 at the time and looked every bit of 14 in all of the flashback videos that we saw of her. She just talks about how it started to become like a very scary situation, but you know, she was still having fun in a sense, you know.
And also, Josh is the man who says, I have never stopped an act in my life. Mm-hmm. When you have these sudden fast rules, when you have these ideas about yourself, what a big man you are, and you make a statement like, I have never stopped an event in my life. It's like, well, do you think you might like to stop this one at some point? Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So he's sticking to his guns. I mean, we're lucky there were no guns. I mean, there might have been. We certainly don't hear about it. And his blame of Fred Durst just tells you everything that you need to know, because it was either the musician's fault, or it was the concert goer's fault, or it was the vendor's fault, because we had no control over the prices they were charging. We just, you know, put in this situation. So everything is everybody else's fault. And he has this very solid idea of himself as a big man, and I've never stopped a concert in my life. As you say, Murray, it's Saturday. They're tearing down the particle board from the sound tower. We've still got another whole day to go, and I'm very worried.
Yeah. And to end this day off, they, of course, go back to the rave hangar where, again, drugs are plenty. Fatboy Slim is playing, which, shout out to Fatboy Slim, who was very funny in this documentary. But also, I did like Fatboy Slim's music. He actually, and then we see the beginning of his set, which is actually very funny. If you want to see the documentary, what they say in the documentary is very good. But unfortunately, all of that energy taken through the day is brought to this rave hangar. And this is where we get one of the only real times. Again, they really do not touch on the sexual assaults. And then, like, when they do, it's like uncensored pictures of women being sexually assaulted, and it's like, I hope you got their permission for that. Something tells me you didn't. But what happens is there's a van that's driving through the rave hangar, which is so incredibly dangerous. And, you know, we get the production staff from the rave hangar telling us the story that they're going to the van. They're trying to get people to clear off of it. They got to get out of there. It's so dangerous. Like, the driver is a zombie. And then they open the door in the van, and the production guy says there's a 15 or 16 year old girl. She looks like she's 15 or 16 year old laying there, undressed, literally unconscious, and there's a man in the back who's pulling up his shorts. And he said, we immediately get her out of there, we send her to the hospital. But he also says, we don't know what happened to the guy in the back of the van. Like, again, you had no security, you had nobody to sit there and be able to hold him there in order to create a case or anything like that. And it was just so bad. And Fatboy Slim was just like so upset to hear this, but he just got out of there. Like, after he was done playing, he said he just went straight to the airport because he could see that it was going really, really bad. Chappelle, what do we think about Saturday? What are you thinking about Saturday going into the final episode, into day three Sunday?
At this point, I was hoping that they would start day three and say, and we were done by noon, you know, like, day, like, we start to wrap this up because it's clearly dangerous. Fatboy Slim is running for his life. and they are finally acknowledging that it's dangerous. Prior to this, they were like, you know, I don't know. It seems like everybody's having a good time. But now they're saying, I think things are getting out of control today. And so I'm like, okay, now that you're there, what are you going to do about it? But one thing we haven't really talked about is that the production people were also partying. They weren't out there working. They were doing acid and stuff and shrooms and stuff too. So it's kind of like, if you wanted to turn to somebody for help, you find somebody in a yellow shirt, you're like, oh, please, Peace Patrol, help me out. Like, maybe I just did, you know, XYZ. I really can't help you with that one. And, you know, so it's kind of like, what did you expect to happen? So, yeah, if day three doesn't end early, I'm thinking we're going to be in for a lot more problems. And it doesn't end early. It actually has a full day three into the night. I was shocked.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, according to John and Michael at the press conferences, it's about 20 troublemakers. No, it's not. It's 250.
It's crazy because they talk about the 1,000 people suffer from heat exhaustion. 1,000 of 400,000 does not seem like a lot of people, but if that's 1,000 of 400,000 that suffered from heat exhaustion, everybody else was on the brink of it. They were close as well, right? It's kind of like they're trying to scale these crimes down to just bad apples. And we see that a lot of times, you know, when things are done by the greater population, they always say, oh, well, it was only a few. It's a one-off thing. This one person had an issue where a lot of minority communities get looked at and we're grouped as a whole, you know, like, oh, look at them. They should not be allowed to do this. They are violent. And so they're like,
white.
Right, exactly. And so they're like, there's only a few things here and there. It's like, no, because even if it is a few things, That's a few deaths. That's a few rapes. Those are things that don't go away. It's not a few purses were stolen. You know, this is completely different. These lives were ruined and taken at this concert. And they are trying to minimalize it to this day. This documentary, people were like, I think the first 2 days went okay. You know, the third day had some problems.
There were absolutely no mentions about the deaths in this documentary.
Not one.
None. Which is
crazy.
We'll talk about that when we get to the ratings. So, of course, the next day, I thought they did a really good job of like Willie Nelson, the documentary here, Willie Nelson being the opener for the day. And they're overlaying like him singing like On the Road Again with people like, yeah, we had to get out of there. Like, it was so good. Like Willie Nelson being
just a cue of cars.
I thought the documentary did a great job.
I have a connection to Willie Nelson. I'm actually from not too far from where he's from. I was born in a town not too far from Abbott, Texas. And they stand Willie Nelson there. There's a street called Willie Nelson Road as well. So I was like, of course, Willie Nelson was involved in this. But also, he is the type of act that you want involved with the vibe that you keep talking about. It's these other acts that you're like, yeah, let's just bring them in too. They won't, you know, help. Anything like this is perfect. Bring in more of this, more of the same. It's like, no, at this point, I'm pulling the plug on all of these rock artists that I'm just bringing out. Just bring me an acoustic guitar and whoever we can get up there to sing. We need some peaceful vibes going. And they just never did it.
Never did it. And this is where we get the shit mud, for lack of a better word. At this point, pipes are burst from people like waiting to get in the showers. The porta potties are overloaded. There's mud on the ground. There are people in the mud, but they don't understand that everything is tinged with feces. The only free water that they had there, all of it, they were saying it was contaminated. It was all contaminated. Sarah, one of the concert goers that was a talking head, she talks about she woke up on Sunday. Her throat was hurting. She had cold sores all around her lips, and she had ulcers on her mouth and tongue. And she found out she had what was called trench mouth. And because of that, her and her posse, they left about 1 o'clock on the third day. Trench mouth.
She was in unbearable pain because she had an illness that soldiers in World War One on the Western Front in the trenches in France suffered from.
Yeah. Imagine going to a concert and coming back with gingivitis. You know,
like, hope it was gingivitis at this point.
Yeah, but it's part of the things you get. It's like a gum disease that you got in a weekend. You know, like that's crazy. That's insane. I don't care what anybody says. You should not be at risk of getting trench mouth at a concert. Like you, at the very least, provide water and proper restrooms for people. Proper sanitation. That's the bare minimum. That's it.
They said the porta potties were kefunked by day one, halfway through day one.
They were unusable. Because Sarah, imagine how many porta potties they would have had to accommodate 400,000 people in general, right? Like, can you imagine? Like, there's no way they even have 100,000 of those. So you got you know, like,
10, 20
constant, right? Like, so nasty.
So disgusting. And this is where we get our public health inspector who talks about how they collected water. I don't know. It had to be in the first 2 days, he said, because he said by Sunday morning when they went back, they opened the incubators and all of the petri dishes were just overloaded with bacteria. This is what I like to see, of course, as a medical technologist. I was like, yep, those are a lot of colonies on those. they overdid it with the petri dish that they put like front and center. That's, you know, that is probably not the type of spores that they saw there. But I did find this just disgusting because your water should not have any type of flora in it. And for them to show it, I'm pretty sure the first picture was the actual plates from Woodstock and they were just overgrown. It was disgusting. And it normally takes about 24 hours for stuff like that to like really get like growing in the incubators. And it was just it was just overdone. I was like, yeah. And I love how, again, the documentary intercut the public health inspector, like, I was just shocked. I couldn't believe that people were out there bathing in that stuff, putting it in their mouth. Him saying that was overcut on people just in the waters, rubbing themselves down, brushing their teeth. I was like, this is effective. This is effective storytelling here, because I am disgusted. I have gotten the hint. This was nasty. So as the day wears on, they're saying that they're at least, you know, people have left. So they're saying there's at least 150,000 people still hanging around, mostly because of some, there was a rumor propagated that there might be a big surprise act after the Red Hot Chili Peppers. The Red Hot Chili Peppers were the official last act. We even get a clip of, is either Michael or Shear talking about how Red Hot Chili Peppers is the official last act. We might have something for you guys afterwards. They wanted to keep that rumor going. There are so many rumors that maybe it would be Bob Dylan would show up, maybe Prince or Michael Jackson. This is at the point where James laughed and said Prince would not be nowhere near y'all.
Oh my God.
Pink Floyd. They thought it might be Pink Floyd.
Yeah, that's, listen, okay. I struggle with this because in my mind, I should have been gone already. If you tell me morning of, I'm about to go, I'm like, this is crazy. Y'all nasty. I'm finna go. People out here getting trench mouth. They're like, will Michael Jackson go be here later on? I'm like, okay. Well, are you sure? It's like, okay, well, maybe it's Prince. I'm like, are you positive? Because I need to leave. I really need to get out of here. But also, if I leave, if Michael Jackson show up, I'm going to die. Like, I'm not going to make it. So I would have struggled with this one, but I would like to believe that this would have been my exit. The water situation, the mud, if you know about everything that's going on, you should be gone already. But
yeah,
that's a carrot you dangle in front of people on purpose. I don't think that's a rumor that it started, you know, just like somebody whispered it. I think production probably had some hand in that one, because you see everybody exiting and you want to keep the party going.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, not only does he not stop it, but he actively seeks, John Scher. I mean, Michael is not, but you're actively stopping them from leaving by saying, we have a very special surprise. And when we get to what the very special surprise is, if they weren't already burning the place to the ground, they would have burnt the place to the ground.
Yeah.
I mean,
And also, but why? You already got those people's money. Like, why? They don't need to stay.
They wanted the legend of it. They wanted the legend of it. I mean, one of the conspiracy theories is that they wanted the rights and they wanted the arson for it to be this sort of cultural moment. I wouldn't go that far, but it's interesting that people are so affected by this greed and sheer lack of care for your guests. These are guests in your home, John Scher. You should have looked after them.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I agree. But yeah, so the people who stayed, including Heather, the 14-year-old talking head here, they stayed to get Red Hot Chili Peppers. You're greeted to seeing Flea's dick several times.
A lot of dick.
Content warning there.
They didn't give us nobody's warning. Maybe at the top. And like I need, when you go show me, because we grew up in this time, Mari. I know that man be naked. But I also get the opportunity to see the video blurred on MTV. You know what I'm saying? Like, so I've never seen him running around naked without the sock. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I need Netflix to tell me when that kind of stuff has happened. Tell me that these women are going to be assaulted on here. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'm sure they did. They probably threw up a little whatever. Maybe I missed it. But I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt and say, I'm sure tiny letters at the top. It probably said TVMA or something like that. Uh-huh. I don't know. But for me, I need more warning. You gotta pause the documentary in the middle and be like, okay, about to get graphic. And I'm talking about when they were grabbing the women. By the time it gets to Flea, I was like, well, I didn't see everybody else naked, so whatever.
I mean, we did get a message from private message from one of our listeners saying that she needed to be warned. I'm in many minds about trigger warnings. Part of me thinks, just watch it. But when you see how this can affect someone, it was the uncensored photographs of the women being assaulted, and it did affect her very much. And that's just one of our listeners who privately messaged us, let alone the many, many people who'll be watching this documentary. So I think, I mean, you know, show me a dick without warning, that's fine. I mean, not in my house, please warn me. But even show me some lovely non-sexual, just breasts walking around a festival. All fine.
Fine.
But it's the photographs of the sexual assault and
the assault aspect,
and
yep.
it gives you an intake of breath. And I don't quite know how I feel about the no warning, but we might talk about that later.
Imagine
you went to this event, like Kristen from our speak pipe. You went to this event years ago, mind your own business. Netflix drops a documentary. You're like, hey, husband, kids, I was at this event. Let me show you how crazy it was. You turn it on and now you see you being moshed around and people are grabbing you. There's no way they went and found these people. Like Mari said, there's no way they got these people to sign off on their nudity and, you know, being groped like that on. There's no way. I just don't believe it. I'm sure somebody's like, yes, they did. I'm like, whatever. I just feel like you got to warn somebody, because if you turn on your TV and you see you, that's not great. Even if I'm just one of the people in the shit mud, tell me beforehand. You know, like, my mama might watch this. I need to know who I need to tell not to watch this kind of stuff. Like, there's no way they signed a waiver for them to just have this footage for life. There's just no way.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't even think about that. That's a great.
Well, point. You having said that, I think John Shear is far too much of a businessman and a rapacious, greedy animal. I mean, they were calling the concert goers animals. They weren't animals. They're human beings. Animals do not do that. But there's no way that in the purchasing of the tickets, one of the terms and conditions is that your image is available to any, because they were selling the pay-per-view at $59. Yeah, the $59.99 pay-per-view. So definitely I very strongly suggest that one of the terms and conditions of buying the ticket was that your image could be used by MTV and John Shear Productions and whoever, blah, blah, blah. Unfortunately for the people who, I mean, some of the still shots are just extraordinary. I mean, really they are bad. Amazing because of the events. But yeah, I take your point, Chappelle.
That's a great point. All right. So let me wrap this up. I'll get y'all thoughts on it. So we get Red Hot Chili Peppers. They are the final act. They get everybody riled up. Of course, Michael Lang, if you let the documentary tells it, has this bright idea to pass out 100,000 candles in honor of the Columbine shooting, which had happened a few months prior to this. They wanted anti-gun violence to be the cause of the festival. Very interesting, since we hadn't heard about that stance until day three here. Very, very interesting here. But anyways, they pass out the candles. They do get this really good shot of as the Chili Peppers are doing Under the Bridge. Great song. All of the candles are lit. You just see the rows and rows of candles, and it is a great sight. Unfortunately, in the distance, there is a bonfire happening. the place starts going on fire. And unfortunately, John Shear and Michael Lang here, they both say that they reached out to the fire department, the fire marshals, and all of a sudden the fire department is like, nope, we're not going to go out there. We're scared. They're trying to tell them, get out there. And they're like, no, thank you. They want Anthony Kiedis to like try and rile the mob down. He decides to play Fire by by Jimi Hendrix. And so more fires pop up. Again, not blaming the artists, but after the Chili Peppers are done, there is no surprise artist. They were lied to. What?
It's
Jimi Hendrix on a big screen. I mean,
yes.
Probably performing Fire.
if they were not riding before, that would have set it off.
Exactly. And this is what sparks the riots. Final thoughts of this last episode, the riots. Talk to me, Chappelle.
This is bad, because you know that people tried to stop him. Like, that's the thing where we actually have a clip of them like on the headset telling like, hey, what are you giving out candles for? Like the fire marshal. And they're like, it's fine. Don't worry about it.
The same 22-year-old that they didn't listen to the first time. Sorry, keep going.
Yeah. But the problem is that you have the opportunity to stop this. But in his mind, he's like, no, we have to get the Columbine shot. Right. We have to get the footage of them doing the vigil. Right. Because it's going to look so cool with the darkness and this song playing and people holding their candles up. And it's going to be a moment. And that's what he risked it all for. He risked it all for that moment. And then everything else is burned to the ground, and, you know, literally and figuratively. It was just like, for that moment, you got it. But now at what cost? You know, now people are in danger. People have always been in danger. But now you got propane tanks blowing up.
Exploding.
Yeah, like fires everywhere. People are tearing stuff to the ground because now, like Sarah said, you have bait and switched them with a surprise performance at the end just to put up footage of Jimi Hendrix. They mad. They mad that they've suffered through Trench Mouth and, you know, assaults and, you know, heat and lack of water and sleeping on the ground. I'm not saying that I would be burning stuff to the ground too. I just think we should hear both sides. That's all. So,
if Chappelle was there waiting for Michael Jackson and didn't get Michael Jackson, if you had convinced him to stay.
Yeah, I'm leaving him with something. I'm from around the way, Mari. I'm leaving him with something.
Well, there was looting. I mean, there was looting. They went to the vendors' tents and they broke open not only the ATMs, but also they helped themselves to T-shirts and CDs and water. One of the rioters in another documentary tells us, I've never been so hydrated, because they got this free water and they drank that. They threw food. It's exactly that, Chappelle, not condoning the thought, but the thought is, you did this to me. I will now take my $150 worth. I will now take what should have been given to me, provided for me, because I bought a ticket and I came to a safe, well-organized festival.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It descends into chaos. They try to break open an ATM. Has anybody ever successfully broken open an ATM and found money?
They try to.
They really tried to. Yeah.
Yeah. I would have figured it out that night. Because you're telling me there were no police there. Like, that's the thing. Like, I'm not saying the police are the answer. But by the time the National Guard showed up, I would have been had that ATM open. I had nothing but time. Time and space. Mm-hmm. And fire.
Fire that you gave them. Right.
Yeah. I would have blew that thing up. I'd have threw it right into one of them propane tanks. I'd have been leaving it. I'm leaving here with something.
I mean, talking about caucasity, the state troopers come in and usher these white boys out the gate.
Two of the concert goers.
Guard comes in and starts getting like swinging billy clubs. I'm like, wait a minute, you got to pick one. Either you're going to lean into these people's privilege and let them walk out of here scot free, like you're doing, or you're going to beat their ass like you would do anybody else, but you can't be doing both. Like, all right, we all do. But also, I'm going to just hit you because I see you. Like, pick a struggle. This was a lot for day three.
Yeah, that was pretty funny. But yeah, so the National Guard has to be brought in to restore order by Monday. At the end of the docuseries, we're getting the aftermath, like the war zone. Michael Lang and John Scherer again are just at these press conferences so delusional, saying how like, oh, it was a terrible ending for a decent weekend. We get just a few of them. This is where they talk about the four rapes that were reported at the festival. We do get Pilar Law, the daughter of the lady who was trying to get everybody to pick up the trash. She was talking about how she was getting phone calls from like irate mothers saying that their daughters had been raped. It was just really, really unfortunate. And this aftermath portion of the documentary, I don't know. I felt like it definitely could have gone into more like consequences of what happened, but it felt like they kind of just brushed over it a little bit. Chappelle?
Yeah, it's all bad. It really is. And the ending, it almost makes it worse because like you would hope that there's some type of accountability, and it just seems like through and through, there's none. There's no accountability, exactly. You know, to the point where after, I mean, this is being filmed present day, like the actual documentary portion, these interviews and stuff like that. And they're still saying stuff like, well, it was real well organized. It just, mm-hmm. there was a few mishaps after day three, or, you know, it got out of control eventually. It's like, y'all still don't see it. Like, are you have to watch this to see exactly what people went through, because you're not listening still. And then yeah. we find out after all of that, Michael Lang passed away 3 months after recording it. I don't even know if he ever saw the documentary. So this man could have died thinking exactly what he'd been saying, what he'd been telling everybody. It's not as bad as it looked. You know, there were some moments, there were isolated events, but for the most part, we did this really great thing, and it's just not the case. So I don't know. I didn't really like the ending, because I was just like, man, it's just so nasty to hear them talk about it. You know, the we wish we could have caught everyone and put them in jail, but, you know, we just couldn't. How do you wish that you could have caught everyone when there was no security, sir? You don't wish that. That's just you talking, trying to like escape accountability for this thing. It was gross. I didn't like it.
Yeah. Sarah?
Well, I think the content definitely was gross. And I think this is one of, I think the great things about this documentary is it does leave us angry at them ourselves. We were not there. Mm-hmm. We don't have friends who were there. I mean, apart from our friend Kristen. And the gross feeling and the lack of accountability from John and Michael is revolting. And I think that's great. I think that's a great piece of storytelling, because we don't get, oh, and then they were charged with this and everything was all right and everybody was happy. That the filmmakers leave us with this incredible anger and sadness and almost a hangover from all the things that we've been watching. Yeah,
I agree. The HBO documentary Woodstock 99, Peace, Love and Rage, which is available on HBO Max in the US or Binge in Australia. Sarah, you were able to watch this, correct?
Yes, I did watch it. It's very different. It's extraordinary that exactly the same event, but seen from a very different angle. The different angle is more sort of sociological, music history. We hear a lot more from musicians and music historians and music journalists. Yeah. It goes in much more detail into the race aspects, and that it was particularly these young white men, not that it was particularly their fault, but that it was basically 249,000 of the same person. And so the mind meld that happened, the fact that they all had the same insecurities and rages and whatever. So that was very interesting to me. And they were much more careful and considered in the discussion of the sexual assaults. We hear from Liz Polly Wattengill, who had been there and had left because she felt unsafe. She set up a support website called Fans Everywhere, just saying, were you at Woodstock? Were you assaulted? Tell us about it. Do you need support? You can be anonymous. And she said it was not four. She said that she got dozens and dozens and dozens of messages from women. She goes into some detail, not a lot of detail, because there were a lot of things happening with the crowd surfing. These women would be passed around. I'm sorry to use that language, but that was what was happening. So I really like the two together. The HBO documentary is much more by the numbers isn't quite what I mean, but it's not flashy in the way that there's a certain flash to the one that we're watching today. But it does stop down and consider race. It considers class. It considers the films of the era and what was being told. It considers gender imbalance. And so I found that very interesting. And I found watching it in this order very interesting, that I watched this one first and then I watched the HBO documentary.
Okay. There was also the podcast You Can't Make This Up interview with the director Jamie Crawford and producer Cassie Thornton. So go check those out. So let's go to our ratings. Chappelle, how many magnifying glasses are you going to give Trainwreck Woodstock 99 out of a possible five?
I struggle with this because the content was very interesting to me. But I do have issues with the documentary in that they left so much out, right? That like there are portions of this where I think if you watch this and you take it as a documentary, you assume you know a lot of the big moments, and not knowing about those deaths and stuff like that really lit, like the moment Sarah said that, I was like, I have to go watch the HBO one now because I need to know everything you didn't tell me. And I know there's, it's really hard to cover things in their totality when they're as big as this, but I think you could try. And so I think this was less about the event as a crime, you know, as a property, and more like, oh, we wanted to entertain you about this horrible thing these people did. It's like, yeah, entertain me, but also I want to know the stuff, you know? And so, because I don't want you to let these people off. You want me to dislike them, clearly. But I want to be well-informed. And I feel like I was not at the end of it. I feel like I missed a lot of stuff. And so I struggled with that. Like I said, the first episode, like I really, the time jumping back and forth was kind of off-putting a little bit. But I enjoyed it. And if you ask me if I would recommend it for somebody, probably. So I'd give it probably four magnifying glasses. And like I said, I think I'm being kind to it, honestly, because the content was entertaining. But I think if I wanted to learn the meat and potatoes of what happened here, I think there's a lot more to be to dive into. And maybe you do extra reading and research on that on your own to figure that out. But I don't want to do that if I'm watching something about a crime or something. I want you to tell me, so I don't have to. So maybe that's how I feel.
I completely agree with that. Sarah, how many magnifying glasses will you give this episode?
Yes, I'm a four as well. I like this very much. I think it's extremely well made. Just stepping back from the content, like the production value is very good. That podcast that you mentioned, Mari, I did listen to, and it's very interesting to hear from the director and the producer how they went about setting it up. The leaving out of things, I'm generally okay. I mean, we have a very outstanding example of when we weren't okay with Keeper of the Ashes. Sorry to keep trashing it, but it was terrible. It has to be selective. And what was very interesting watching the two documentaries side by side is each had a sort of lane that they wanted to be in. My ding would be you can't just say sexual assault and then leave it. Like, you either don't say it or you say it, and you do need to give it some space, some moment. It didn't have to be long. It didn't have to be dug into, but it had to be marked. I think that they thought having John Scheer saying it was an acceptable amount of violence and assault gave that to us. But while I don't want the documentarians to tell me what to think, I actually needed them maybe to sit with me for a moment about it. So I do think, a little bit was missed there. I was very surprised to research and find out about the deaths because they weren't mentioned. But again, I say, you can't put everything in. You must pare some stuff away. I thought this was extremely good. I absolutely recommend it. But just be warned, there's an enormous amount of sort of gentle, kind, peace and love nudity, and then there are some very graphic images. So just be warned about that. Plus shit mud. So be warned about that as well.
Love shit mud.
Trench mouth.
Shit in the mouth. Mari, what about you? How many mags for you?
No, I completely agree with you guys. If we were going off of just entertainment value and watchability, it would be a five. But when we also factor in like information presented, how they left out what I feel like leaving out the deaths, like you can cut other stuff out. Like, I'm not stupid. Like, I am looking at this documentary like somebody died, because there's no way you can have these many pitfalls and have this much stuff go wrong and there not be some loss of life. Like Chappelle said, some effect of life. And so I would give it a three for that. So let's give it a four. Like, I agree. I completely agree with you guys. It is a four because it is truly very entertaining. It really is. I all of that aside, and I hate to say that, it is very entertaining the way that they layer the musical acts, the way that they do the interviews are so entertaining as well. Like, we didn't go through a lot of the talking heads, but the talking heads were fabulous on this documentary. They really did have people who were there in the trenches and the mud.
So with the trench mouth.
With the trench mouth. Yeah. So I really did enjoy it. And you got me to rewatch a three-part docu-series from tip to tail again. Like normally I kind of just skip around on the second rewatch if looking for the important parts, but it truly was that good and that entertaining. But I just can't get around the big pitfalls of not, you know, a big part of what we do is do we get to hear the victim's stories when we talk about stuff like this? And effectively you don't. They're silenced and they're actually used in the property, you know, with their bodies being shown, and we don't know if they're, you know, down for it. So I have to ding it for that. You truly have to ding it for that. So four's across the board for us. Sorry if that's anybody was time. hoping for some levels.
But no, I can go lower if you wanted me to.
No.
It's just something about care for your, it's just something like care for your audience too, that I'm just kind of like, I want to kind of ding it a little bit more for that. Because again, this, I just have this unnatural feeling of, if you know somebody who was a victim at this thing, and then you go to watch it, and then they are graphically describing how that person is a victim. Oh, we opened the back of this van and we saw them pulling up their pants. You know, just care for your audience a little bit more. I could give it 3.9.
Fours across the board it is.
Chappelle, do you have a recommendation for our listeners?
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I really liked about it is that this was not like a dramatization a lot of times. Like, this was raw footage that they had from the event. And I like that a lot. And so if you want more of that, one of my favorite documentaries that I watched this year was Genius, the Kanye West documentary. Not that it's a crime or anything like that, but it is. I like the way they documented it in real time. So you didn't have to assume what was happening. He had the actual footage playing. It was more of, let me just play this footage straight through, than a documentary. And I really like that. Like I said, this is kind of more my realm when it comes to true crime, more like these events and stuff like that. So if you haven't seen Fyre Festival coverage, then of course Netflix has one, I think it's called Fyre, and then Hulu has one that's called Fyre Fraud. Watch them both.
Which is better. They're both good, but I like Hulu better personally.
Exactly. Yeah. And then, I love Blackfish. Oh, I love Blackfish. I watch it all the time. It's so heartbreaking, but I watch it. I get in my Woodstock vibe, and I just watch Fyre Festival and Blackfish sometimes. So check that one out too. But like I said, sometimes you just want some comfort watching, and sometimes you want to watch chaos, and there's chaos in both of those things. So those would be my recommendation. But thank y'all so much again for having me. This has been fun.
All right, Sarah, what about you?
Oh, well, I want to double down on Blackfish. It's truly an extraordinary documentary, quite something. If you're really sensitive and you can't watch animal cruelty, do not watch it. There's no way around it. You can't watch it between your fingers and be okay. But otherwise, and have someone to hold your hand while you're watching it, I think. For me, I'm going to recommend the series, documentary series, The Way Down, W-A-Y, on HBO in the US and Binge in Australia. It is true crime. It's diet culture. It's religion. It's cults. It's the biggest hair you have ever seen on someone who isn't a drag queen. I love this series, but I also, every episode, it was like, how is this real life? How is this not a performance? It's not enough to be a parody. It can't be. It must be true life. Mari, I know you watched The Way Down as well.
I did. And one of my favorite interviews in The Way Down is a few of the Black patrons being like, nah, I can't do this no more. Yeah, so thank you guys so much for your recommendations. Here at Crime Scene, we are eager to hear your feedback and suggestions for future episodes. You can follow Crime Scene on Twitter at Crime Scene RHAP. That's at Crime SEENRHAP. And you can send us an email to crimescenerhap@gmail.com. Also, go follow us on Instagram. We have an Instagram now. We post pictures about the documentaries we're covering. Go leave us a comment over there. Get in on the conversation about what we're talking about. You can follow us at Crime Scene Podcast over on Instagram. Chappelle, what do you have going on, and where can the people find you?
People can follow me on Twitter at Chappelle's_show, where I'm tweeting out all the podcast links and just tweeting randomly. I do that a lot. But mostly podcast links. So this week I was on the Big Brother Wednesday recap on Rob Has a Podcast with Geneva and Rob and Mary. And we talked about one of the most recent episodes of Big Brother. So if you're a fan of that, check out that recap. Rob and I also host the Nothing But Netflix podcast, as you probably know if you listen to episode one of Crime Scene. And so this week on Nothing But Netflix, we are talking about Untold, the Manti Te'o story. And then I'm also going to be, I was on the finale of the 90 Day Fiancé podcast. So if you're a fan of 90 Day Fiancé, if you watched the Tell All Part 2, check me out. I'm talking about it over on Rob Has a Podcast as well with Puya. I got to come on the finale and drag people to hell. It was fun. I got to talk a lot of trash, but it's over. So check that out. And then Sasha Joseph and I are talking about the hit show on Netflix, Never Have I Ever, on Silent Podcast, wherever you get your podcast, for more information on that. And I think that's it. I probably missed something, but it's cool. They won't know. They're not. Listen. They're going to charge it to my head, not my heart.
Where can the people find you, Sarah? Well,
they can also find me on Twitter at Sarah Carradine. I certainly am not shy of tweeting out all my podcast links. I learned that at the feet of the great Chappelle. This week I talked about Married at First Sight on the Perfect Match podcast on RHAP with Asia Welsh and Jason Reed. And that was great fun. I love going over there and just talking like I know what I'm talking about all these people I've never met, but I have very, very strong opinions about. What about you, Mari?
Well, you can find me at Mari Talks Too Much. That's two, like the number two, on Twitter. Same thing. I will be tweeting out all of my podcast links. Me and Matt will be coming back with the Wrestling Wrap Up podcast pretty soon. So just go follow me on Twitter and follow Matt at Matt Scott GW on Twitter to know when we come back. But basically, we break down the week in wrestling. You don't even got to watch wrestling, but you can just go and subscribe at robhasawebsite.com/wrestlingfeed to get notified when we come back. Sarah, what do we have coming up for next week?
Well, next time on Crime Scene, we're watching Leave No Trace. It's the downfall of the Boy Scouts of America. And we are absolutely delighted to be joined by Ronald Young Jr., an ex-Boy Scout himself, to break it all down. So you can watch it on Hulu and send us your comments and questions.
Thank you, Chappelle, for joining us. Will from America for the theme music, Tricky Rice for the graphics, and Scott St. Pierre behind the scenes. Until next time. Case
closed.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.